Okay, I think we'll start. I was looking out at the O parking space to see if the chancellor's pulled in yet, and not yet, but we'll go ahead. I'm Chris Connery, and I am chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom. And I wanted to, I think you all seem to know this, but there's a handout that Eben wrote that's available for everyone, and you can pick up one of them if you don't have one. On May 21st, 2004, the Academic Senate at UCSC passed unanimously the Patriot Act resolution. This was co-sponsored by the Committee on Academic Freedom, then chaired by Barbara Epstein, and the Committee on Faculty Welfare, chaired in fall and winter by Faye Crosby, and in the spring by Onatum Narayan. That was the year in which Helene Moglen was chair of the Academic Senate, and she was also involved very heavily in this resolution. And at that point, Marty Chemers was acting chancellor. And as if you can remember, back to May of 2004, it was the beginning of a long period of transition at the higher administration in our campus that maybe has settled down. The full text of the resolution is on the Senate website. The resolutions had a number of very specific recommendations regarding our campus's implementation or non-implementation of elements of the Patriot Act, and called for a report from the chancellor on action or non-action pursuant to that resolution. And I think it's because of this long administrative instability at the upper level that didn't happen. But I'd urge you, those of you who are interested in this issue, to look at, on the Senate website, the text of the resolution on the Patriot Act. It represented a lot of work from our colleagues, and it's a very forceful resolution about whom all present at the time were very proud, and I think we can be proud of having done that on the campus. In 2006, then-Chancellor Denton provided funding to a large group of faculty called Faculty Against the War for an event held on April 24th of 2006 called the War on Terror, A Credible Threat. This was a day-long teach-in on the War on Terror that was held in the Upper Quarry, and it had dozens of speakers ranging from political celebrities of the period like Richard Wilson to activists from Watsonville. All of the organizers and participants agreed that Eben Moglen's presentation was one of the most important ones on that day. These were all short presentations, but Eben made the following points, among others: that the university, our university, and universities in general, depend on, for their very existence, their independence from political or other interference in the pursuit of knowledge, and that there have always been threats to that independence, and that at the current time, in 2006, universities had, in many cases, needlessly and unnecessarily given up a wide range of freedoms and rights, and that this was a mistake, not only due to the deleterious effects on the rights of faculty, staff, and students, but because, as Eben said very eloquently, the university should strive to be exemplary for the country, for the world, in maintaining and promoting and fostering a culture of free inquiry, democracy, and openness. It was a short presentation. He also mentioned that there were a number of concrete policy steps that universities could take in this regard to better embody its mission. Immediately after the teach-in, when Faculty Against the War met, the group decided to set aside some funds to bring Eben back to campus to help us talk through these issues, work out plans of action, possible plans of action, see what campus needs, campus desires were in these areas, and to see and discuss what we could do with them. And last year, the Committee on Academic Freedom agreed to sponsor the event. In addition to today's lecture, Eben will meet tomorrow with a smaller group of IT staff and administrators and faculty to discuss some implementation strategies. We're very grateful to Professor Moglen for making the time for the visit, and I personally would also like to thank Susanna Rangel and others in the UCSC Academic Senate staff for all the work they did. Susanna has been wonderful in making the arrangements for this event, and the Senate office, as you know, is not normally an event sponsoring institution, so it's more work than usual. Eben Moglen is a graduate of Yale Law School. He has also worked as a computer programmer for IBM. He has a PhD in history at Yale. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, and he's now in the Faculty of Law at Columbia University. He's widely published in IT issues. He is, I think, one of our foremost public intellectuals on these issues, publishing not only in specialized academic journals, but in journalistic forums of a variety of kinds. Eben's sought after as a speaker, as a consultant on these issues. He's an important voice nationally and internationally. And I would say that in all my dealings with Eben in arranging this visit, he has been gracious, generous, and enthusiastic about what he thinks we can accomplish here at UCSC and what he thinks that will mean for academic freedom and electronic freedom in general. So it's really with great gratitude that I introduce Eben Moglen and thank him for coming, and thank you all for coming too.
Thank you, Chris. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm delighted to have the chance. I want to thank the Committee on Academic Freedom and Chris and Cultural Studies, which is allowing me to interrupt a week of extraordinary activity in order to give a speech, which, as Chris pointed out, I gave a better version of in 6 minutes 2 years ago. It is unfortunate, I think, to be brought so clearly face to front with my older, or was it younger, self. At any rate, he was quicker and more eloquent than I'm going to be, I fear. Let me see what I can do. The university is, at its heart, an extraordinary and self-contradictory institution. It represents the gateway to power and the operation of the levers of social control. And throughout the long history of the university in the English-speaking world, that fact that the university is the gateway to power and to control in the society has meant a strong degree of interest and concern with limiting the damage that the university could do as an autonomous part of the social order. The great private universities, both in England and in the United States, are institutions whose potential for harmful disruption of society is limited by their strong relationship to the church, that is to say, to other structures of intellectual control. And of course, whether we're thinking about Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or Yale, the moment of their origination is the moment at which the production of parties skilled in the manipulation of religious social control is the goal which the founders and sponsors of the university mean to put forward. Of course, in the process, in the magical transmutation of power into freedom in the history of the West, the university comes to hold its other great and surpassingly inspiring position in our thoughts as the place where free inquiry and free learning and free teaching and free speech have an embodiment, a physical place, precincts with a semi-sacred character about them, within which privilege of one kind or another inheres. And it is unfortunate, but true, that if we think about academic freedom in that long secular sense, it's an outgrowth of privilege. Privilege legal as well as privilege social in nature. It is the semi-sacredness of the precincts, the presence of a chalk circle of a magic kind, even, if necessary, certain peculiarities of law. The great English legal historian Frederick William Maitland at the end of the 19th century found, among other interesting little puzzles to work on, the puzzle of the existence in the English law of a thing called the corporation soul, an individual with the attributes of a corporation, with the attributes of an institution inside him. The two great examples of the corporation soul in the English law are the bishops of the Anglican Church and the wardens of Oxford colleges. And the similarity in structure is a reminder about the similarity of social function. The deeper one goes then into the history of academic freedom as a legal conception or as a social claim, the further one comes back towards the idea that there are those who have privilege and that their privilege is just, that their privilege emerges from their special reckoning with the knowledges that are close to power, and with a special relationship, therefore, to the wealth of the church, the state, and the moneyed power. To be a good Congregationalist in Boston in the 1640s or 50s or 60s or 70s was to be a member of the board of the Artillery Company and the overseers of Harvard College. And to be suspected, as one Robert Kane once was, of economic offenses against religion would be to lose one's place on the board of the Artillery Company and the overseers of Harvard College as punishment for an incorrect balancing between the purity of the soul and the importance of commerce. Robert Kane was so hurt by all of this that he wrote a long apologia in place of a will and testament at the end of his life, primarily in order to have his say out on the subjects of the relationship between purity and commerce. And we owe to Bud Balin's extraordinary skill in finding documents the apologia of Robert Kane and everything that we learned about Puritanism and the economy because of it. But it is, if one sets out to tell the story of the university in a sort of Whig triumphalist way, as the great partisans of freedom rising towards power over the years through the rise of the middle class, it is unfortunately, unhappily, a more contradictory story than that. And as usual, it is the American experience which provides the transmutation in a democratic direction of that structure. I've pointed out that the great American private universities are the work of the institutions of social control seeking to provide themselves the best trained and most effective participants in the process of hegemonizing through the church. But that is, of course, not why American public universities exist. American public universities exist for very different reasons, and they're intellectual outgrowths of a very different temper of mind. It is conventional, I guess, even now, was more 30 years ago, to talk about the role of the Scottish Enlightenment in the growth of the American newness, and in particular to the idea of human beings as endowed with an inherent moral sense, capable of providing decent but not authoritative guidance in the act of being free, and requiring some additional training and education, learning and contact with experience to be fully self-actualizing as agents of moral and political equality, or at any rate, liberty. And of course, it's there that the sticking point long was. Jefferson's University of Virginia may be devoted to the pursuit of Scottish Enlightenment realization of the moral sense, but it is not in pursuit of equality, it's in pursuit of liberty, and we don't need to belabor too much what the difference is in that context. If you think, however, about the Morrill Act and the land-grant universities of the United States in the 19th century, it is a very different story. It is now the idea that the wealth of the continent can be harnessed to provide for increase in the value that human beings attach to learning, and that from that can grow economic value. It is the Whig promise of the Civil War, free soil, free labor, and free men. And it is a very different turn in the meaning of the university. We are fortunate to be standing here in one of those works. I'm particularly conscious of that, living as I do and working in a private university created in order to provide Episcopal clergymen to New York in order to prevent the Presbyterian New Light from extinguishing the king's intellectual prerogatives in New York. And though for the past 21 years I have rarely run in to the Episcopal Church as a primary interference with freedom. The king's crown still sits on the top of the university building where I live, and there's still a king at Columbia, one way or another. This brings us, I think, now to the point at which I can begin to try to get concise and to become something like the speaker Chris reminds me I used to be, before I got long-winded. We are living inside the physical embodiment of a belief that the institutions which saw academic freedom as a matter of privilege can be turned instead to institutions which see academic freedom as a matter of democratic right. That there is a public interest in the making of free inquiry, free learning, free speech, on free expression, that that public interest is an interest which is no further away than the education of one's own children. Abraham Lincoln's belief in the land-grant colleges and in the Morrill Act is the belief of a man who remembered his mother teaching him to read by chalking with burnt charcoal on the back of a shovel, right? It is about the idea that access to knowledge is the beginning of freedom in a democratic society. And the universities, the public universities of the United States, were built with that in mind. But that was then, and this is now. The great experiment with post-Second World War socialism in American education is now over. It had two components. Its belief was that those who fought the war were entitled to an education from the government as partial compensation for the risks and harms that they had suffered on behalf of the society, and secondarily in the pursuit of science that would win the war against godless communism. Those two forces, the GI Bill and its successors in the attempt to ensure equality of access to education, and the enormous public subsidy through the military budget and related components to research in the big universities, created the great university system in the United States, which was the drawing port for the brains from all over the world in our society. And for three generations, we benefited exclusively, almost, in the world, from the ability of people to come and to gain access to knowledge and to achieve, even as visitors and temporary sojourners in our society, self-realization of the kind that promises from free inquiry. Beginning with Ronald Reagan in 1981, the first of those pillars was kicked away. Within a very short period of time, the federal government's willingness to commit itself to ensuring equality of education through access by those without money to pay disappeared. Let me give you the arithmetic from the world I know best. When I think about Columbia University, the numbers are really quite staggering and clear. When Ronald Reagan was inaugurated, Columbia University as a whole had a financial aid bill of about $16 million a year, of which the federal government paid six. When I was first a university senator in 1989-1990, Columbia University had a financial aid bill of $36 million. The federal government's contribution had gone from $6 million to $6,750,000. and the university was running a $20 million a year operating deficit, essentially the equivalent of an attempt to maintain, simply to maintain, the same degree of economic egalitarianism in access to education that had been present 10 years earlier, in the face of a complete refusal of the United States federal government to go along. And of course, Columbia University is not a primary agent in the education of the poor. Along with the disappearance of a commitment to egalitarianism in access to education went a fundamental dissipation of the great Cold War big science budget. As you may recall, that was occasionally qualified, particularly, but not exclusively, in Republican administrations, by attacks on the management of universities, discrediting their integrity. The president of Stanford University, as you may recall, was forced to the point of resignation by the question of the overheads on research grants being used for flowers for the president's house. Similar investigations, they may contribute to our sense of, you know, Schadenfreude with respect to the professoriate temporarily raised to great power in office. Efforts of that kind were really based not in an attempt to increase the integrity of university accounting, but instead for the purpose of discrediting institutions which were seen as politically threatening to anti-egalitarian ways of thinking about American politics. And everyone was, of course, deeply conscious of the possible role of universities as fostering political dissent. Universities have therefore been on what, compared to the diet that led to the greatness of the post-Second World War American university, they've been on short commons. And they have responded by opening themselves much more deeply to the private market economy than they did in the three generations following the Second World War. This is not unheard of. The last time we had robber barons in America, the period from 1875 to 1912, about which I have had more than once to write in relation to the age of the internet because it is so very similar to the age in which we created the internet, another period of robber barons in American society. But at the end of the 19th century, it was dangerous to a professor of economics to teach from a pro-labor union point of view in any one of America's great universities. There were firings constantly as a consequence of the desires of those who provided financial support to the university not to have Red Revolution preached in the institutions that they sponsored. Once again, if I may make so bold as to treat Columbia University as a particularly bad and sorry case, people are aware that the Red Scare after the First World War and the crisis over the draft during the First World War resulted in purges of the Columbia faculty. And Charles Beard is a name, I think, sufficient for the purpose, but there were many others. In other words, we have experience with the relationship between a moneyed class, substantially feeling its oats in a period of temporary invulnerability, trying to reabsorb the freedom of knowledge in America for commercial gain, or at least to protect themselves against ideologies unfavorable to their incumbency. And it is, I think, apparent to everybody that in the last 10 years we have moved largely back in that direction. Sponsored research, private market sponsored research, private market research sponsored by pharmaceutical companies, if I might just point in one obvious direction, has become a force without which university managers cannot calculate to a way that keeps red ink off the bottom line. And accordingly, there are inevitable results politically and ideologically of that renewed dependence of the university on private market money. But what I want to talk about is genuinely new, because it has to do with the interaction between these long-standing curves up and down in the relationship between private power and academic freedom in democracy. It has to do with the relation between that long oscillation and the technology of today. Everybody who teaches and most people who learn are aware of the fact that people's access to information has radically altered in the last 15 years. And students are not the people they used to be. And research and learning and communicating are not the tasks that they used to be. The presence of computer-mediated communication means that it is now possible, if the legal and other ancillary systems stay out of the way, for any human being anywhere to learn anything at any time, following only the desire to know and the presence of something that communicates with the net. Of course, when I say that it is possible for anybody to learn anything anywhere at any time, I am ignoring two forces, one of which is old and the other one of which is new. The first is the need for teaching. That is to say, anybody can learn anything anywhere, anytime, except that we all need teachers. That's a condition of being human. We require human interaction and human relationship in order to stimulate the nature of our thought processes, both to surprise and delight and to confirm and support us, sometimes even to act like a sharp stick across the back of the buttocks, but usually not. And in those human relationships, which are face-to-face relationships, we derive a good deal of the value of whatever in the information is that we pass back and forth. I am very grateful to Chris for making it possible for me not to give this speech in a telephone booth. If I were speaking at this moment in a telephone booth, bad as it would be worse, because it is your presence here which makes it possible for me to organize my thoughts in a way based not around whatever whim my neurons may dictate at the moment, but my sense of responsibility to you to provide ideas in a way that can be understood and thought about and shaped, and students in relation to their teachers experience that. This is why we are not afraid that our business will be put out of business by the internet. We sell theater tickets. We sell seats. We sell seats in live performance because it is in live performance that learning really happens. And therefore, unlike many of the parties in the economy, including many of the parties whose donations and economic leverages now nearly control the university, we do not have to be afraid of the technology of sharing knowledge. Let me point out that that's the name of the net. In 1995, not actually Albert Gore, but one of his deep friends and supporters, Marty Peretz of the New Republic, used for the first time in the high discourse of policy the phrase, the information superhighway. And in a piece I gave in 1996 at a conference at Columbia University on telecommunications policy, I called attention to that choice in relation to what seemed to me then a sort of Parringtonian irony in which a second great barbecue was developing on which nobody was reporting because it was the media themselves that were the beneficiaries of the slurping. And so I worked for a while on a book now dead called The Invisible Barbecue, designed to show by what means that funny Parringtonian moment happened in American culture and what followed from it. I gave it up because it became more necessary to do something than to write about it. But at that moment in 1996, with the words information superhighway fresh at hand, I wrote to ask what would happen if instead of calling the net the information superhighway, we called it the universal education system. And how would our policy have been different in detail as well as in the largest of geometries if we had adopted that perfectly plausible way of describing what we had made instead of this other, to my eye, less perfectly plausible way of describing what we had made. But the information superhighway was, like any other superhighway, a corridor for the transportation and delivery of stuff. Things for people to buy, things for people to sell, things for people to wear and eat and look at. And this, of course, was indeed what, in some sense, it was that we were building, at least from the point of view of the very people who came, in the course of the net's development, to control more and more of the university. But what about the universal education system? The university is the universal education system. That's what uni is in there. It's the universe rendered in a way which frees minds. Now, there are other ways of rendering the universe so as to free minds, and I have been a lawyer for some of those things for quite a long time now, that constitute ways of making technological information for sharing, and then on the technological information made for sharing, software that everybody can use to make the net behave in ways which improve sharing, there is the cultural layer of shared knowledge that follows from it. The Wikipedia, without which at least most high school and some undergraduate students believe that learning itself cannot go on. The Creative Commons structure for the distribution of shared culture in a whole variety of new and interesting ways. The free software movement itself, which has had an enormous effect on the global software industry, an effect I myself, a partisan, tend to think of as completely excellent and entirely beneficial. But whatever may be said about the pleasure that people took in it, the thing I will say about it is that the pleasure that people took was natural. Human beings are sharers of information by their natures. In addition to the requirement of social interaction for the thing that we call learning, we do social interaction for the thing we call communicating and sharing information. That's what we do. That's what socializing means. When we can't share anything truly valuable, we share a lot of meaningless but attractive information about one another that we call gossip. And we use gossip to keep the channels of sharing open when we cannot find anything more immediately urgent to share. But if you think about the sociology and political psychology of gossip, you are thinking about what in network technology is known as keep-alives, things that render a connection still vital and keep it from going down when there is nothing immediately pressing, passing through it. The networks, then, are reflections of the human capacity and need, indeed the human fixation, for the sharing of information. They are a full reflection of human being in its human state. I don't know whether dolphins would build networks. It isn't clear, probably. It seems likely that there are other near-human creatures who would build networks, or if the ethologists were here instead of me, they would say every animal builds networks and that it is characteristic of life. E.O. Wilson would certainly say that I'm ignoring the internet of the ants, which is as deep and capable as the internet of the humans, though it doesn't discuss baseball or rugby. I don't know whether it discusses pornography, but I have a suspicion that it must. In other words, what grew up around all of human society and around the universities most thickly, was a mechanism for sharing superior to any which had previously existed. The reason that that mechanism is so good is that it allows for interconnection on almost any arbitrary geography with minimal or insignificant or absent intermediation. That is, the thing we call the internet a thing, or the thing we call cyberspace a place, is actually, to me, a condition of social structure. Not a thing and not a place, not reified, but humanized. It's the condition of everybody being actually or potentially attached to everybody else without intermediaries at will. And anybody who sees how students use cell phones knows that actually or potentially connected to anybody at will without intermediation is pretty much the way they expect things to be all the time. So we have systems of sharing of extraordinary power, capable of performing what all education, and university education in particular, has always been designed to do. That is, to make it possible for minds to absorb whatever they have a mind to absorb. Those systems of sharing are most thickly clustered around the places that we call the universities, because they were made of university thinking, and they are kept alive by university behavior. That is to say, it is all of that good talk which in the end motivates the existence of the net. But precisely for that reason, the network is particularly vulnerable to the changes in power structure around the university, and not only around the university. To call it the information superhighway was to miss an opportunity. To operate the net the way we are presently operating, it is not to miss an opportunity. It is to create injustice and misgovernment, inequality and poverty. And we have to stop. The problem is that we have lost the power to stop without negotiating with parties who simply don't agree with us about our aims. The owners of knowledge have profited vastly in the last 20 years from rules expanding greatly the meaning of the ownership of knowledge. With respect to the traditional legal forms of copyright and patent, trademark and trade secrecy, the rather miscellaneous bunch of tools mixed in a bundle called intellectual property, both inside law school and outside, the power of the American empire has been used not only greatly to expand the range of owners' privileges in the United States, but to force an increase of owners' privileges on other governments around the world. Copyright, to the framers of the United States Constitution, a privilege granted to authors for their writings for a limited time in order to encourage publication of those works and to create reasons why they should be made available rather than being left unpublished. Copyright was to the framers a matter of a 14-year statutory monopoly on printed books and possibly maps to be renewable for 14 years in the event that the original human author still lived. Copyright at the present time, as you may know, embraces not merely those subjects, the books, the maps, but sound recordings, video, and all other fixations in any tangible form of any work of creativity. And the term upon which it is now guaranteed is 70 years to 90 years, and for incorporeal authors, that is, corporate holders of rights, for longer terms than for authors who are actual human beings. The law of patent in the late 18th century was a law of emigration encouragement. The purpose of the patent law, as understood by Congress, was to encourage the immigration of skilled artisans, because under 18th century conditions, technology transfer requires moving the brain of the person who knows about the technology. A rich and powerful society in land, poor in people and poor in skilled tradesmen, chooses to offer as an immigration assistance the availability of a limited commercial monopoly, again for a short period of 14 years, in return for the publication of everything you need to know in order to practice the skill being monopolized. And everything you need to know in this world and through the 20th century means a working model thereof, to be consulted by the eyes and hands and the curious mind of anyone who cares to do so. It requires, then, a physical object physically performing in the world in a novel and unobvious way. I have seen in the last few years a patent, now a 19-year statutory monopoly, protected against the importation of any competing goods. I have seen a patent claiming for 19 years a monopoly on how to put ice cream in a cone. I have seen a patent on how to train immigrant Mexicans, they are so referred to in the patent, to clean office buildings. Microsoft holds a patent on how to evade one of my free software licenses. In other words, a 19-year exclusive right to profit from teaching other people how to break the law. The nature of the change in the patent system, like the nature of the change in the copyright system, was a desire to increase privilege among those already privileged. It was a simple, easy, highly technical, but nonetheless quite clear example of the very same thing we heard this week when a presidential candidate declared that it's a tax cut if it goes to rich people, and it is unacceptable welfare payments when it goes to poor people, which causes you to recognize that there would be, in a government so constituted, a phrase that would go, "I'm sorry, you're not rich enough to get a tax cut." Right? which is essentially how the intellectual property law of the last 15 years has operated. Those of us who chose to design legal machinery which helped people share, in other words, which allowed them to sculpt out from the large burden of exclusive rights given to them by statute, just the ones necessary in order to facilitate sharing, we have been regarded by and large as the enemies of intellectual property law. We have been regarded as the enemies of owners and incumbents, and I suppose not because we started with enmity in our hearts, but because we were constantly aggressed against, after a while that became more or less true. My clients are people who want to share. My clients serve other people who want to share, and what they want to share is the work they made themselves, not somebody else's anything. Yet that in itself is often a sin serious enough to require some heavy lawyering to prevent them from being hurt for. The university is unfortunately a place in which a lot of that hurting goes on. Music, since the beginning of music, which is pretty much since the beginning of pre-humanity, music is a social activity. You have to be there to do it, right? It's a thing that happens between people. Mr. Edison's inventions, for the first time, made music something which could be, I'll use a technical term here, alienated. It was for the first time possible to take music out of the social circumstances in which it was made and to put it in a can and move it long distance as a commodity and sell it for consumption. And the Edisonian inventions and the package of social activities that they made possible transformed music in that way from social communion to product. Sharing music, however, remains a natural human thing to do for all the reasons previously given and for which no new reasons need to be given. They are just the way we are. Sharing music when everything can be shared at the press of a button is a natural thing to do. The four companies that control 95% of the world's popular music have, through their trade association in the United States, the RIAA, and the lawyers retained for them, they have now sued more than 38,000 people in the United States, almost all of them young people, many of them using university networks, for illegally making available music for others to share and enjoy. Unfortunately for them, this theory that it is a violation of copyright to make available music is a false theory. Many of the world's copyright statutes make it a copyright infringement to make a copyrighted work available, but not the copyright law of the United States, which requires instead for infringement a copying, a modification, or a redistribution of the music, or a public display or public performance of the music. In other words, the making available theory, which the recording industry adopted for technical legal reasons, has always been a bogus theory. Many courts in the United States, after too easily accepting the theory for a while, have begun rejecting it, and two courts of appeals in the federal system have already indicated that they no longer believe in its justice. But on the basis of that theory, and working very largely through university campus networks, the music industry has sued, as I say, more than 38,000 people. They have collected more than $79 million in damages through those lawsuits, or rather the settlements which they induce from those lawsuits. Lawsuits which you settle if you're a young person charged with illegally making music available, you settle the lawsuit by paying money. The average settlement is somewhere north of $2,500, and promising never again in your life, on pain of imprisonment for contempt of court, never again to share music, teach the sharing of music, or advocate the sharing of music. On the basis of such settlements induced from young people with the assistance of the universities they attend, including this one, the recording companies have, as I say, collected almost $80 million, and not 1 cent of that money has so far been identified by the music industry as a royalty cent owed to an artist. Not one. Mysteriously, All of these children sharing all of this music so very illegally have so far failed to share any piece of music on which even one red cent is owed to any musician for any reason. It's quite an extraordinary demonstration of the skill of the children in anticipating the state of earnouts in the popular music recording system, right? Or else it's a sign of some other thing, which I leave to the reader to determine. In other words, we have turned the territory of the university into a stomping ground for extortionists. We should stop. Beginning in October of 2001, as we now know, the United States government began to move with great coherence towards the placing into action of a system for communication surveillance in the United States exceeding anything ever performed in the United States, ever. We know what it was that they were trying to do because they tried to do it many times before. The Patriot Act, to which Chris referred, is in this particular area, and even the unconstitutional or at least warrantless surveillance, which we later learned was going on around and behind the Patriot Act, all of this had been previously discussed in the course of the 1990s by the spooks and the cops in the course of elucidating what their plan for a digital society would be. In 1995, for example, there was a vast legislative fight on Capitol Hill, now remembered only by the poor bloody infantry who fought it, over the question of digital telephony. As the large telecoms carriers, the oligopolists that resulted from the AT&T breakup, began to digitize their telephone systems, the cops, more than the spooks, came to them and said, "This will not do. Once you put 100 million telephone conversations inside a glass fiber, where will we put the tap?" Therefore, said the spooks and the cops, the spooks are always offstage whispering to the cops, you understand, that's their preferred place. Therefore, said the cops, on behalf of themselves and the spooks, "You must design the digital telephone system so that we can get access to any conversation in real time that we need. And you must do that at your expense." This was not an easy lift on Capitol Hill because the telecoms oligopolists are very supportive of politicians in a financial sense. They have a large equity interest in the smooth running of the United States Congress, and they were not eager to have imposed upon them the costs of doing the spying. But there was a good deal of negotiation over the actualities and the needs. Having lived through this, though I was fortunately not compelled in those days into the trenches, I remember the meeting at which the special agent in charge in New York City indicated what it was that the FBI regarded as necessary to get from Verizon, as it then was, 9X. And what the Bureau said was, "We need access simultaneously to the content of 2% of all the conversations on Manhattan Island at any one time." And the Verizon guys just looked at him and said, "What? 2% at any one time? You must be kidding. Don't you understand? You're telling us that what you need is for us to build in capacity for you to be surreptitiously listening to 50,000 telephone calls all at once?" "Oh," the Bureau said, "but you can't ask us to take any less. What if we had two major undercover drug investigations going on at once, listening to several dozens of people? And remember, we're going to need their cell phones and so on, as well as their stationary phones, the so-called roving wiretap. What if we have two such investigations going on and there's a big terrorism problem? We might have to tap 10,000 phones on Manhattan Island in order to find out who has the bomb. You can't give us less than 2%. Well, in 1995, that seemed quite an extraordinary thing even to ask for. On September 11th, 2001, the major telephone switches in the bottom of Manhattan Island were destroyed, most of them in 7 World Trade Center. The consequence of which was that there was a long delay in restoring telephone service to many parts of Manhattan Island, longer on the Upper East Side than in Harlem, where I live, which is an unusual experience if public services are out and you compare response on the Upper East Side and in Harlem, but much longer on the Upper East Side than in Harlem. We, of course, have no actual knowledge, but there is every reason to believe that the delay was in the construction of a system capable of delivering what the spooks wanted. They had, of course, a major terrorism incident on their hands. And so we believe, with respect to New York City, that the reengineering of the telephone system provided the kinds of immense simultaneous access to telephone calls. Oh, but this isn't any big deal, right? You understand that every single web page coming into this university can be surveilled, right? You understand that every single piece of email going in and out, which you all send and receive in an unencrypted form, can be read by anybody who chooses to read it. Deep packet inspection, that is to say, looking inside each 64-bit piece of information flowing on the net to see what's more than just the header information, may be a no-no, may be a no-no. But the header information says from whom it came and to whom it is going and what it is about in terms which are pretty easy to infer from if you are talented in that way. And if you are a computer program talented in that way, you can be deciding a whole lot of stuff all at once. Our economy is full of workers who are fully surveilled on the job all the time. Not all of them work at investment banks about to go broke. Some of them work here. After 2001, and indeed after the passage of the Patriot Act, it became possible for the United States government to issue a national security letter, an order for the turning over of information otherwise private, without any opportunity on anybody's part to challenge the order or even to know that it is there, because parties to whom it has been delivered are prohibited from saying so. There are national security letters in use in the University of California to seize the email of students who do not know that they are being surveilled. I know that to be a fact, though I cannot disclose how I know it or how I learned it. I do not know whether it is a fact at Santa Cruz, but since it is a fact at Berkeley, it is in all likelihood a fact here. Though it is not legal for anybody to tell you on this campus who has received such a letter that they have received it, it would be legal for them to tell you how many they have received, and you should demand to know. The scale on which it is occurring is itself an absolutely crucial piece of information to you in assessing one aspect of the extent to which your network has become a servant for outside parties seeking to impose power over the process of knowing and exchanging ideas. Since the beginning of the Columbia academic year, that is, since the Tuesday after Labor Day, 14 students in various divisions of the university have come to me to say that they are under threat of one kind or another from a music company or a movie company in relation to sharing. And those are just the people who happen to come to me. You might want to know what the scale of such activity is here, unless you are directly related to that particular part of the IT network management. The chances are that you do not. In general, the people who are aggressed against are students, timid of declaring that they have done something wrong. And there is so little desire for pushback against the entertainment companies among most university managers that even saying how much of this is going on is more than people will be prepared to undertake. Last year, I was consulted by the client I have been dreaming of on this subject for quite a long time. The distinguished visiting professor voluntarily invited to attend Columbia University in a distinguished professorial role from abroad, who brought to the campus the laptop computer of the child in the family in a far-flung country somewhere else outside our law, and who did so because that was the small portable computer in the household. Having had it checked out by university IT personnel, this visiting professor installs it in the office awarded and goes about the business of being a distinguished visiting professor until the professor receives a note demanding $30,000 in damages for offering to share music on a computer previously checked out, as I say, by university staff. I went to the university lawyers in my usual way, and I said, you know, I don't think this is the thing you want to do. I don't see the percentage in it for you. Why don't you just tell them to drop dead for a change? After a good deal of thinking and a bunch of whispering around and a good deal of complaining about me in quarters which were supposed to convince me to go away, University Council came back and they said, well, we agree with you that there is something wrong here. How about if we just pay the tribute demanded by the RIAA? We can get it down to a few thousand. Well, we'll just pay. Our problem, the University Council said, in all seriousness, our problem is we can't figure out how to pay it. We can't very well just put it on a university credit card. I said, well, I think actually you have a bigger problem than that. I said, because my client will under no circumstances sign the agreement which will accompany this settlement, under which my client will promise never to advocate sharing music, which, given that my client's spouse is a distinguished international musician, is not likely to occur. Moreover, my client is not likely to agree that coming to the United States in order to accept a distinguished visiting professorship is a reason for abandoning for life freedom of speech, which in my client's country is hard won and needs defending. And people have died for it. And I don't think my client's going to agree to give it away because you have decided that you can't tell a recording company to get lost. I have to tell you that my guess is that the difference between Santa Cruz and Columbia is that there's nobody working in a law school here. Which means that there's a lot of trouble. And that trouble is just little points of trouble adding up to a really large problem, which is the loss of why it is that we do what we do. Because why we do what we do is to be parties to the free exchange of information and the liberating consequences of the sharing of knowledge. We can't be anything else. Anything else, and we are merely agents of indoctrination for somebody else's business. Whether that business is government, or that business is pharmaceuticals, or that business is entertainment, or that business is telecommunications, it does not matter. If we are not free to teach, if we are not free to share, if students are not free to teach us and share with one another, then we have lost our ability to do what it is put to us to do, what our obligation is. One could multiply examples, but I don't think that's really the productive part of the story. The productive part of the story is that managing our technology in the aid of freedom is not more difficult than managing our technology in ways that erode freedom. Once again, it is made up of a lot of little pieces, and the little pieces are all merely symptoms of the larger commitment to use technology to reinforce freedom. But the commitment to use technology to reinforce freedom, combined with a willingness to use the technology aggressively to support freedom, that is to say, not merely to hold the barrier of free inquiry where it is now, but to move the barrier of free inquiry back towards where it was 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, is possible for us, eminently possible for us. It requires a little bit of trouble. Some trouble to the managers of network infrastructure, though not much. Some trouble to lawyers, though not much. Some trouble, more trouble, the most trouble, for teachers and students and researchers and staff who have to maintain vigilance. And vigilance in defense of freedom is troublesome, not merely because it is vigilance and you lose sleep, but because it requires knowledge, it requires cunning. It requires persistence. It requires an unwillingness to go away. All of which it is trouble to get and trouble to keep and trouble to use. In my world, there are lots of people who feel vulnerable. They have jobs that they can lose. They are afraid of what will be done to them by forces more powerful than themselves. And when I consider the problem of the network in the university, I find myself asking time and time again that one great true academic question: why are the tenured cowardly? This is another one of those problems which can be solved by all the ingenuity and all the creativity and all the energy of the university if only those who have complete safety of employment will use the courage that that safety of employment was designed to help them build. There are lots of things to be said about tenure, and the older I get and the more young people there are who want my job, the more, of course, I am determined not to say any of the bad things about tenure that I know. But the good thing about tenure is it's made for this. It's made for forcing the institutions to observe their values. because tenure is made of those values, all compact. And there is nothing but those values for tenure to support and defend and cherish if it is to be anything other than privilege extended. So now comes the time when we go to work with the recognition of a problem. Our networks in our universities are the stuff of life, intellectually and socially, not only for the universities, but for the society. Our networks have become a contested battleground in a battle most people have not realized was going on. And even those who saw the consequences saw but few of them and tended to personalize them. It is something done to me, not something done to us. Those who have attempted to build coalitions on this subject have been readily defeated by the technical nature of the subject, by the specializations necessary, all the skills necessary to engage the conversation fully and effectively. And because right now everybody is very conscious that there is barely enough butter to go on the bread, and that much of that butter is provided by people who don't like the free exchange of information because it hurts their business. I recognize the truth of all of that, and still we must not give way. Because what is at stake is genuinely what we can call the soul of the institution, without grandiloquence and without inaccuracy. The pathways that make it possible for us to share information are the pathways that must be defended if we are to survive. Anybody asking what would have happened if they had started locking up books in McHenry Library in 1975 or 1980 will understand what I mean. The defense of the traditional pathways to free inquiry in the university has been strong from time to time. And it must be strong again. But to be strong now, it has to be guided by a degree of technical and legal skill which is daunting to acquire offhand. 2 weekends ago in Berkeley, California, there was a meeting of free culture in the United States. That is, the Creative Commons, Wikipedia, free books, access to knowledge, access to drugs, people. And during the course of that weekend meeting, the students and faculty and free culture activists gathered together in Wheeler Hall on the Berkeley campus, hammered out what they call the Wheeler Declaration, which is an invitation to free culture communities on American campuses to provide for report cards for their home institutions in an array of areas concerning access to knowledge and free culture on campus. How is the university licensing its patent portfolio? And with what charity or respect for the public good? How is the university adopting or not adopting open source and free software technology to reduce costs and increase efficiencies and provide more freedom? And for the purposes I am presently talking about, most importantly, how is the university managing its network for the purpose of ensuring free access to knowledge and limiting the harm done by outside parties seeking to control, extort, or impose power on students and faculty alike? My point here is to say that if you choose to lead, there will be people right behind you. We are at the point now where it is possible to imagine the gathering of a nationwide meme and a coalition of politics that follows from that meme. It is possible to give a narrative for the reclaiming of the university now that will be echoed in many other places. I came here not only because Chris and his colleagues had been saying, you know, you owe us a visit, but because I genuinely believe that this is where it all is going to begin. I genuinely believe that here, of all places, here is the place where we can say first, okay, so the broad generalities of the Wheeler Declaration, which I didn't know was coming, but which arrived on my doorstep the following Monday morning with the knowledge of great minds thinking alike, we can make here policy which shows how. and others will follow, because students and faculty and researchers and staff at other universities are waiting for somebody to show the way. So I have good news, right? We've come to a real point of choice in the narrative. We've lost a lot of rounds. A lot of stuff happened that we didn't notice happening. A lot of stuff happened that was concealed from us. A lot of stuff happened because even transparent university government isn't all that transparent. The campus of the university, the public university, is public space the way the streets and the parks are public space. It should be possible for the public to communicate here over a network which doesn't spy on them. Similarly, of course, there are services provided here which must be offered to authenticated users. They are people who pay tuition. They are people who have rights. They are people whose role in the community demands that they have access to or power over information. But drawing the distinction between the public sphere and the authenticated invitation-only sphere in the university is crucial work. And Santa Cruz, with its extraordinary history of understanding the role of public space in the university, as well as understanding the importance of free inquiry, is a place to begin using policymaking to define that difference between the private space, the subscription space, the you are here because we selected you, you are a member of the club space, and the great public internet and the great public land that lies beyond. Here we can do some extraordinary things, and we can do them as a beacon to others, a light upon a hill, a city, in fact, upon a hill, if we come to that. And we probably ought to. I don't read the paper all the time, so it doesn't bother me all that much. It's not a cliche to me, and Peggy Noonan didn't ruin it just by giving it to Ronald Reagan. It comes from Jonathan Winthrop, the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It's from a sermon that he gave in 1629 aboard a little boat called the Arabella, 45 feet long and about 13 and a half feet wide, containing 50-some people sailing to the new land to make a new society and to hold themselves godly in a world that they thought was being ruined by power. And Winthrop's goal in the sermon is to convince people that there is something larger than themselves that they are the examples of. And so he says to them that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of the world shall be upon us. And if we shall keep our covenant and walk in the ways of God, then we shall be magnified. And people will say of all settlements in the future, let it be like this one of New England. But if we shall fall to prosecuting our carnal intentions, if we shall palter with our God, then we shall be consumed entirely out of the good land whither we are going. Private rights cannot subsist, he says, in the ruin of the public. And his sermon is a model of Christian charity, where charity means both loving and sharing, and where the point is that we are in it together in that city on a hill, and being in it together, completing our work of charity and sharing, is what makes us worthy of being thought by all the world to be a beacon and an example. This is a good time to do this work right now. This is a good time because the other forces have been stressed and strained, and it is not so easy for them to ride herd on us all as it was 5 years ago or even 6 months ago. This is a good time to do this work because the people who are here with us, younger than us and more energetic, know what we are talking about. They live in the network. They grew up there. It's their native country. And if they allow it to be polluted by the crimes of power, then they will lose what they have always had, which they have never known anything better than or different from. And it's a good time because around the country there are people waiting expectantly for someone to move first so that they can follow along. We have lost a lot of rounds these past 5 years, and I have been there often when the handkerchiefs were still wet. The good news is, this time, we win. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions. This is more than I know about, and I should look, and I will overnight and see what I can find. But remember that the problem of retaliation is a problem primarily of people who blow whistles in secret. Retaliation against the group is not a strong thing to fear. I don't think there will be retaliation. I don't think that what I'm calling for is steps that we will have to fight over first. I think what I'm calling for are steps we're going to have to negotiate over first in order to help people see why the whole community's interests are really more aligned than they think. The lawyers, the technicians, the teachers, the students, we're going to find when we get down to it, when we roll up our sleeves and actually try and make new policy, that we can do it more easily than we think. Out past that point, there lies resistance. But it is resistance not within the university if we do it right. It is resistance to the university's assertion of its autonomy and its power of decision and its right to protect free inquiry and free communications. And that's a fight the university can win. So if this were to turn into a whistleblowing situation, I suspect that would mean that the strategists did their work wrong. And I don't think that's where it's going to wind up. Bob?
So that they have to promise consumers degrees of protection that they then breach when they cooperate with the government. What is the role of, are you asking us to use more of the legal mechanisms of the kind that led the phone companies to be sued because the government required them to assume liability for consenting to allow the government to do what the government already had the capacity to do? But it couldn't use what it had the capacity to do without the phone company's consent and without forcing the phone company to assign liability to it. They can get our email anyway. There are people on this campus doing research in IT. And you and I both know people in Silicon Valley who develop the same technology for searching email that Google uses or Amazon uses for recommending books.
No, I think it's too simple, and I think it falls to the kinds of counter-strategies which are suggested by the colloquy between questions. I think we need less polarizing solutions, and I think they are available. I would point out that I, too, have a president. He's Lee Bollinger. He's a theorist of free speech, and Lee hasn't found a way to answer the question how many national security letters on the Columbia campus yet either, and I've put that pretty much as pointedly as I can do without actually spitting on his shoes. I think that we should allow for the fact that our colleagues who do the spying on university campuses don't like doing it. Makes them feel dirty and uncomfortable. What I know about what's going on, I know because the workforce occasionally says something, because it feels quite uncomfortable and wants to quit when it is asked to go and root through somebody's mail, and they say, where's the court order? And the word comes back, there isn't any, do it anyway. Which is, of course, what this is all about, not using the law. My position in the policy paper that has been circulated in such a bright yellow form. It looks very cheery, I must say. I hope it is as cheery as it looks. My position about this is that what we need to do is to begin by setting a principle of a mutual responsibility to push back a little bit. The university should require the intervention of a neutral magistrate before it agrees to turn itself into a surveillance source or a source of testimony against members of the community. It is asking no more than we have asked for 700 years in general. Get some neutral decision maker, present it to him or her, get a decision which has the benefit of not being made by a spook or a cop, but by a judge, and bring it here, and then we will cheerfully do what we are asked. If we were actually to expose the full weight of all of this to the ordinary mechanisms of the rule of law, it would die. And we don't have to go to war with one another in order to promise to invoke the rule of law externally against outsiders who seek to turn us into informants against one another, which is what they're doing. So, from my point of view, it is possible to explore means that are less dichotomous and that don't require us to know whether we are living in the city of God or the city of man. We are living here together, and we are in it together. And the unease that we feel about the wrong being done is inside the heads of those doing the wrong, too. We could take a retributive approach to that, but we are better off taking a therapeutic approach to that. We'll all feel better when we're all on the same side. Let's get on the same side. Let's put the anxiety over where it belongs on the guys who want to separate us from one another. I think that there is real promise in that. I believe that there is real promise here, and I hope that a conversation of that kind going on tomorrow will explore the possibilities. I think that it is not beyond hope. I also think it's not beyond hope to do the same with respect to students. There's a good clinic at Berkeley now. There's a good clinic at UCLA. There will be another one somewhere else very soon. We could begin to provide legal services, not from university counsel, but from people who really want to do the work, for students who are charged with or who are extorted from, for reasons that arise out of their use of university networks. And if we did that, once again, we would push back against power in a way that would cost us no solidarity at home and would put the war abroad where it really belongs. I understand your point that at the theoretical level there are conflicts here that may be impossible to remedy. In the end, however, it is true that Augustine has been gone a long time and we still manage to get up, and some of us don't even worry too much about the things that used to bother him. In other words, I think we can lift a little bit of that burden from ourselves, not quite in theoretical perfection, but in the lawyer's usual way, with a little bit of gray in the mixture of the thing, and maybe it isn't all exactly perfect, but it moves us away from what was horrible and therefore in the direction of what's better. I'm sorry. Yes, if you wouldn't mind. National security letters are not a court order. National security letters are written by the guys in the Justice Department whose names you have learned and whose failings you are now well informed about. National security letters are the outcome of pure power. There is no judicial review of them before they are issued, and there is no judicial review of them after they are issued. They are, to you and me, what Guantanamo is to the people who are there. Not a work of law, but a work of power. So I'm not just suggesting that, I'm stating it.
If you were in the university,
there's an advantage of externalizing, or that's the advantage, but the advantage of internalizing it, that you could, should you so choose, employ much better protocols. So you could enable things like StarTLS.
You haven't?
I'll try to be brief. So there's a protocol called StarTLS, which is opportunistic encryption between mail servers, mail exchange servers. So the university, this university at one point, had StarTLS enabled, and the last time I checked, it was disabled.
Wow.
So what StarTLS does is the one protocol that protects against government's current program of mass surveillance of social networks. So the government hasn't said we have a program of mass surveillance of social networks, but the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the New Yorker have all said that high officials have said we're building social networks of everyone in the United States, and we do it by reading the to and from, and it's not illegal because there's no constitutional protection against that kind of search and seizure because it's held by a third party or whatever. But so anyway, there's an easy fix, and it's you just enable in configuration file StarTLS.
No, it's more complicated both legally and technically than you're making out. The problem with the approach you're taking is the assumption that where email is intercepted is on the wire. Having a TLS or an SSL session running between my client and the mail server doesn't actually protect the privacy of the mail.
Right.
You'd be better.
Whether
or not, right? I mean, only on the wire, whereas where the email gets taken is in the spool. And there it is protected.
It's totally different. That's a totally different case law. It's totally different to store communication.
That's right. So you have protections under the electronic privacy, electronic communications privacy act with respect to stored mail. You would really be better off if we backed up a step, as you'll see in the paper I've circulated. My idea is that we actually move towards bundling GPG inside people's mail clients.
Right, which doesn't help at all against social networks.
Nor can you. The pen register.
You turn on
no, they'll just serve the warrant. I mean, that's.
But the thing is that you can't warrant everyone in the end.
You don't have to. You're missing the you're missing how things really happen. But let's put technical detail aside for a second and agree that what we wanted was a goal. Our goal was to make the interpersonal communications of people within the university genuinely private, because we think people have a right to that. And now we are addressing the question, will we have to do it ourselves or can we outsource it? And unfortunately, the answer is the one you see. If we're to do it, we're going to have to do it internally, which means we are going to remain in the email business, which means we're not all going to be at Gmail. And that will indeed make things very much harder for university postmasters and all the very hardworking people who deal with that. We will destroy Microsoft, and with the end of that, we will have the end of much spam and much insecurity. And it will get easier over the next decade rather than harder, because so much of what has gone wrong went wrong because monopoly software didn't need to have features that were important. It just needed to be monopoly software. And we will get some pieces of the email infrastructure clean up from the triumph of non-proprietary software in the email infrastructure. But if we're going to give people real interpersonal security for their communications, we're going to have to teach them how to use encryption end-to-end. We're not going to be able to do it by encrypting back office wires alone. And that will mean actually doing the work that we do, right, which is teaching people how to use networks. Because even kids who come who have been using networks since the beginning of their lives can learn new things when they get to college. And one of the things that they can learn is how to protect the secrecy of their email messages better. Now, with respect to this other question of social network analysis and the taking of the sort of traffic information from the whole stream, that's a political problem. You will not get it solved here no matter what you do. It's a political problem which President Obama is not going to address. He's already made perfectly clear he doesn't mean to address it. And so there's going to have to be politics to make it happen. I think that politics is possible. But I didn't come here to say that we could deal with that. I don't think we can, not by ourselves. What I think we can do is make some other decisions which are probably more important. If, for example, we reduce the number of things you have to authenticate for in particular, if we reduce the possibility that you have to authenticate to get an IP address, we will find a lot of other things are getting simpler. We are turning the network into a genuine public space with anonymity and non-traceability in it, until you come to the point at which you want to perform an activity that requires authentication and makes you trackable. And you know that you are crossing that barrier from a free public space where you cannot be seen or surveilled, because we guarantee that for you technically, to a space where you can be tracked, surveilled, where records are being kept, and we remind you of that fact so that you know what is going on. We banish the MAC address from everywhere, because it's unreliable information, easily forged, which is currently used to track too many people for too many reasons. And so we just stop paying any attention to it once the switch no longer needs it for routing purposes. We take steps towards policies of minimal intrusiveness and maximal active privacy protection. How we fight about those technical details interests you, interests me, may not interest anybody else in any given room, but we will have lots of time for those conversations. After we have established some basic principles for policy, then the question of technical and legal implementation will fall to specialists, and we will do what specialists do. We'll wave our arms and jump up and down and yell and scream and waste a lot of chalk, and eventually we'll figure out how to get it done.
I agree with you on everything, and if you have time, I believe that I can convince you that social network analysis is completely fixable.
That's the beauty. That's the beauty of technical ingenuity. You may very well be right. I have been working with hackers for 20 years, and my principle is never underestimate a hacker.
In your presentation, you touched on another whole set of issues having to do with independence of university research of the private sector, intellectual property licensing of patents that are produced by the faculty members. How do they fit in your roadmap for these things, and where should our priorities be?
I believe that these are problems of equivalent scale and scope, and that they raise issues of freedom equally deep. Let's take a couple of examples. There is no reason for anybody on this campus ever to pay for a telephone call, because VoIP is here, and it works, and we should be using it. Among the reasons that we don't are patents. Among the patents that are causing us problems are patents on SIP. Among the holders of SIP patents are Columbia University, and Columbia University would like to monetize those patents at your expense. The Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation attempted to tax everybody doing human stem cell research in the United States through control of certain basic patents in stem cell research. When you all convinced California to put up money to do what the federal government would not do, Wharf announced that it was going to tax your bond issue by requiring payments. My partner, Dan Ravisher, and I went and made a credible case that we were about to destroy those four patents, and Wharf backed down. It is not infrequent that such matters have to be undertaken in order to assure that other universities can work freely where some university is attempting to tax everybody else's knowledge. When we destroyed the patent on co-transformation by Dr. Joseph Axel, Columbia University lost $120 million in planned patent revenue. And you may be sure that if I take $120 million away from my employer is mad at me. But I have tenure. In other words, the university and the patent system is actually not a two-party game. It's the university, the patent system, and all the other universities. In other words, it's again what happens when you clog the free exchange of information. What we need are principles which allow us to understand how to exchange knowledge freely in those places where free exchange of knowledge is crucial, while permitting monetization of information to those parties who in return charge for whatever it is that they do to add value. In the world of software, we managed to do that pretty well with respect to copyright law. We created regimes like the hard copy left of the GPL, which allowed people to share who wanted to share, while preserving for themselves business models that allowed them to monetize often the very same programming technology in other contexts. We need to be able to do the same thing with the patent system. It is possible to do. We are beginning to build some of the infrastructure for such a hack to the patent system. But in order to do that, we have to convince people that responsible behavior with respect to university patenting is a crucial component. Otherwise, we shall spend a long period of time destroying university patents and making researchers angry at one another. How dare you destroy my patent? All of this, of course, was a fight created by the United States Congress when, in the Research Act, it gave universities a reason to take patents from the professoriate and to monetize them. Congress deliberately created a system in which universities would become parts of the patent system. Universities would become intellectual property managers, and Congress created a regime in which that was supposed to pay universities back for public support for education, which was being reduced. The Bayh-Dole Act has enormously bad consequences for the way we practice freedom of thought in the American university. But it has now become embedded in every university's thinking that there is patent revenue out there for them without which they could not make ends meet. And so it is not possible to be purely abolitionist. We're going to have to withdraw from this situation with the same care and clear thinking that we avoided going in. So far as the question of where the priorities are concerned, I think the priorities are on open access to information. The priorities in research committees like yours, Hoki, are priorities for making sure that the great problem of the scientific, technical, and medical journal oligopoly is solved. We need to attack the duopoly of Thomson West and Reed Elsevier because it controls 100% of the STM publishing in the world to a first approximation, and that's causing people to find that they can't afford journals anymore for university libraries where the people are trained to do the research that those journals report. We need to deal urgently with questions that involve international access to knowledge, which relates to access to medicines and other international campaigning, but whose real intellectual headquarters is the United States. If research committees are working as hard as they possibly can on open access, and if some other policymaking goes on concerning infrastructure, I think that would be ideal. I do not think it should be the job of people working on research policy for the university also to solve the problem of network, what shall I call it, despotism. Okay, I'm going to go and use that word. I think network despotism is a really important problem, not as important as access to knowledge overall, and it can be solved more simply. We can work on it. The great problems of access to knowledge are still there. Might I point out that there is a wonderful piece of free software called Zotero that lives inside your browser that does what EndNote does and does citation management for people, and that Thomson West has sued it, trying to prevent it from existing? Nature has editorialized on the subject already. It's a piece of what we were calling last year Firefox Campus Edition, and already it's supposed to be a piece of illegal software. I'm working on that problem now. There's no end of attempts to lock up free access to knowledge and control the research system. Its crucial point in right now, I think, is control of metadata. All that metadata out there, which is the source of license revenue models for the publishers, we have to free the metadata first. We have to make sure that access to that metadata for interoperation purposes is absolutely uncontrolled by patents or other forms of monetizable intellectual property, right? After we've done that, I suspect we'll be able to see more clearly because a lot of dust will have settled. That's okay.
But I guess my question was, why do I deserve to have the right to listen to somebody else's music, watch someone's movie, TV show, their stand-up, anything that they did in an attempt to make money so they can live and thrive in our capitalist society? Why should I have the opportunity to listen to them for free when they're just trying to make
Well, let's separate two questions here. The question that you're asking most narrowly is, why should you have the right to break rules already agreed to by people with respect to a particular work of art? And I am not declaring that you do have such a right. In fact, I don't think you do. I don't infringe copyrights in my own personal behavior at all, and I wouldn't advise or encourage or assert a right to infringe copyright. Now, if you ask me, do musicians benefit from this system in which recording companies own their music in return for loaning them the means to live? The answer is no. Can we provide a better distribution system for artists which they will like better and will choose preferentially, in which your right to listen is not based on your ability to pay? Yes. We can make it better for creators in all the media, both the video media and the audio media you're talking about, and lots of other ones as well, to abandon the system of coercive distribution. I won't give this to you unless you pay. We can abandon it and still give the artists a better shake, because the Edisonian industries of the 20th century stole from artists at a level it is hard even to conceive. The average music recording contract provides, notionally, a royalty of at most 7%. That is to say that if you are a signed artist with a standard recording contract, you will discover that the maximum take you get is 7 cents on the dollar. That means their minimum take is 93 cents on the dollar. In fact, however, if you inquire, as has been done, and you'll see the research if you care to go and look, if you inquire what a survey of 20,000 recordings produces with respect to how many of those recordings earned any actual money for their artists at all, you will discover that more than 89% of all the recorded music that is distributed by recording companies pays zero to the musicians who made it. Okay? So the best you can get is 7 cents on the dollar. You are overwhelmingly likely to get exactly 0 cents on the dollar, which is why musicians did not actually do very well in the system of recorded music presently prevailing. The real fear of the recording companies has not been that you were going to steal. The real fear of the recording companies has been that musicians would desert. The primary reason that they have built these extraordinary machines to attack the frictionless distribution system is that the frictionless distribution system is better for artists than their system, and they need to keep artists having no choice. All right? If you want to see an experiment in non-coercive distribution of music, in a way which will give you a way of thinking about your relation to the artist a little bit differently, I would suggest that you take a look at a place called Magnatune.com. Magnatune.com is a 21st century music distribution company making money out of music for both musicians and distributors. John Buckman, who made Magnatune, has a pretty simple business model. His model is, you bring me already recorded music. I don't do studio recording work. I don't need to. Everybody's got one. Bring me music. I'll decide whether I want to distribute it. If I want to distribute it and you're a Magnatune artist, then anybody can come to my site and listen to the music as often as they want. If they want to download it in any one or in as many formats as they please, they get to nominate a price. The bottom price for a CD length set of music is $4, but it goes up to wherever you care to give. And the artist and I split 50-50 whatever you nominate with respect to each recording that you take. If you download a recording, please feel free to give it to three of your friends without any further licensing, because that's good for all of us. More people hear the music, more people know about Magnatune. You get to give music to your friends, which is what you want. If you want to license the music for commercial use or otherwise to embody it in some other work, click here on license and we'll do an immediate license with you over the net, very frictionless, you're set. He has about 330 artists recording for him in all genres, including, just to pick an example which matters to me, Andreas Hörflich, whom I think is the greatest Mozart pianist in the world at the moment, who left Deutsche Grammophon to record for Magnatune.com. And Mr. Buckman was not profitable only in year 4, or in year 3, or in year 2. Mr. Buckman was profitable in year 1. Just in case you want to know, the average price paid for a recording at Magnatune.com is not the minimum price, $4. It's slightly over $8.25, which means that people are voluntarily choosing to pay at least twice as much as they could pay for the music because they love it. I think that the basic question that you're asking, which I am asked, as you may expect, all the time, pretty much everywhere I go, is a right question. But what I think you need to understand is that the answers to the question are developing. They are real before your eyes. Alternate models for the production and distribution of almost every kind of digitizable culture are being built around you. And the story that the way to make people make things is to give them a capitalist profit motive based on an exclusive power to prevent the poor from hearing, reading, or seeing just turns out not to be correct. I think we really do need to stop. I'm very grateful to you for listening so long. Thank you so much.